Blog Talk Radio.
Can't believe 2014 is done. It's over. It's you can write it, put it in the book. So much happened in 2014. Last week we had three different guests: Mike Barra speaking on Mars, Frank Joseph speaking on his interest in Atlantis, and of course Bill Donato and his archaeological discoveries in the Bimini Islands. Those people will continue to be part of Earth Ancients, and always I suggest that you jump on to the Facebook page of Earth Ancients Facebook, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past, and keep up to date on what's going on. I'm going to increase the coverage of from those individuals as well as many, many others. Our guest today is also one of these individuals who's constantly keeping an eye on what's going on. But before I bring David Hatcher-Childress on with us live, I want to remind everyone that the phenomenon known as the Bosnian Pyramid Complex is a fascinating subject, not only because finally engineers, chemists, and other scientists are going out to the site, analyzing the structure itself. But more information is coming to light on just how this structure was built. And I posted a really interesting analysis of the concrete. It's called Ancient Bosnian Concrete. And a couple of different chemists have talked about the quality of this man-made complex. Now, for a long time, people have felt that this was just a mountain that had a bunch of tunnels in it that people felt that was considered to be not man-made at all. In fact, even Robert Schock said, no, this is not a man-made structure. This is a natural formation that may have been converted into some kind of sacred site, he doesn't really believe that it was a man-made structure. Since his leaving there, which I think he was there a couple of years ago, a number of scientists have come out and done analytical studies, not only on some of the stones formations that make up the complex, but some of the most interesting work is done with the cement. And if you look at this post here, again, it's called Ancient Bosnian Concrete. There is some research where one chemist from Yugoslavia believes it's one of the hardest man-made water-resistant artificial concretes he's ever seen. And I have a picture where you can actually see these monstrous slabs that make up the side of the hill. And what it really shows is that this pyramid-shaped structure, which is a pyramid, actually, at one time, tens of thousands of years ago, was actually a building of some kind. It's so big. It's just mind-boggling how big it is. So do take a look at that. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, 2015 is upon us, and we will continue to cover a lot of the updates in not only archaeology, but discovery, investigation. We have a great lineup. And today, my guest is David Hatcher Childress, who kind of breaks the new year for us. And David has been writing for 3 decades, if not longer. I was a big fan of his his books on travel to Africa. His first book, Hitchhiker's Guide to Africa, Arabia. A big fan of his Lost Cities, Ancient Mysteries of Africa and Arabia. And just a prolific writer. And apparently, I just read this somewhere, he's published over 200 books with his company. And that's fascinating. So, David, how are you today?
Hi, Cliff. I'm doing good.
Great. Great to have you on the program. We didn't get a chance to have you on the program last week, but I'm just curious, with all your travels and your business and your personal research, and you have a lot of personal interests in a lot of these things, as well as being on television programs like Ancient Aliens, what was your kind of neat discovery in 2014, or what were some of the things that you thought were, that you had fallen upon that were like, wow, that's kind of cool?
Oh boy, I mean, there's so many things happening all the time. Last February, I went to Nan Madol, the remote island of Ponape in Micronesia. I'd been there before, but I discovered new things. Nan Madol is like the 8th wonder of the world. There's over 200 million tons of basalt stacked up, and over 100 artificial islands there. And the largest stone that I found there, and this was new, weighs 80 tons. And it's...
Wow.
Yeah, when you go there and you see Nan Madol built into the ocean, and just the sheer amount of material that's in that city, and it's most of it's underwater, and because they've created all these artificial islands, entire mountains would be dismantled to create that incredible city of nearly 100 artificial islands, walls of basalt as high as 30 feet. I mean, that place is the most astonishing, amazing place in the world. I mean, it defies explanation in many cases. And the islanders claim that all of that basalt, over 200 million tons of it, was flown through the air and magically stacked up under these walls and islands. It's incredible. And in fact, one of the new places that I want to see, and in our magazine, World Explorer, we're going to have an article on it, actually by Andrew Collins, about a similar place in Indonesia, in West Java, called Gunung Padang.
Giant,
you've probably heard of it and maybe mentioned it on your
radio
show.
We've been talking about it. Yeah, we've been talking
about
it.
That is also basalt. Yeah, it's similar to Nan Madol. I have yet to go to that site, and in fact, I only really learned about it in the last year. But that I suspect that the same builders of Nan Madol are the ones who built Gunung Padang in Indonesia, and in a similar way with all of this basalt is super heavy, super hard, igneous rock, but it's magnetic, and basalt lends itself, in my mind, to levitation and anti-gravity type stuff. In a sense, it would be easier to levitate basalt, I think, because of its magnetic properties. say, than some other stones. Granite, too, with all the crystals in it, is probably also relative, you know, a stone to levitate. And I think that in my mind, and I mention this in a lot of my books, including Ancient Technology in Peru and Bolivia, which came out like 2 years ago, that, yeah, the megalith builders, in order to work with these 100-ton, 200-ton, 500-ton, 1,000-ton blocks of stone, I mean, it had to be easy for them. They had, in my mind, they had to be able to make these stones weightless, somehow levitate them and lift them into place, rather than it being
right.
some, you know, extremely difficult, you know, manpower of thousands of people, you know, dragging these stones around.
Yeah, the research that has been published on Gunung Padang in Indonesia shows that on the fifth level of one of these caverns, they've dated organic material to be about 20,000 plus years old, which is just mind-boggling. And of course, conventional archaeology doesn't want to even consider that. But this place that you're mentioning, have they dated the site at all in terms of...
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem with archaeological dating, particularly at Namadol, is that structure, that 200 million tons of basalt, it's actually in the ocean. And it's, I mean, you have to go through it in a boat. It's in a swamp. You can wade through it. You have to wade through these canals. You have to deal with high tide and low tide and stuff when you're there. But they can't really date it. But they have tried. And, I mean, this is a big mistake that mainstream archaeologists often make, where you go into a megalithic site and you're looking for something to date it with. You want some organic matter, a tortoise shell, a campfire, a burial, finding some bones or something like that, perhaps a wooden or even a ceramic artifact. These things can all be dated, but there's a problem with that too, in that when you have a megalithic structure like Namadol, even say Tiwanaku or Machu Picchu in Peru as an example too, when these sites have been there for, say, thousands of years, and you're saying, you know, 20,000 years for Gunung Padang in Indonesia, but when you have a site that is sitting there for such a long time, and it's megalithic, I mean, in many of these places, the stones are so huge, they can't really be destroyed or removed. In many cases, earthquakes and tidal waves and other disasters have destroyed these buildings. Tiwanaku is similarly destroyed that way in some kind of earthquake and tidal wave that came out of like Lake Titicaca or something. But when these sites are sitting there for thousands of years, then what happens is nomadic tribes and other people, I mean, they're, so let's just say some site is sitting there for 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 years. In that 5,000 years, all kinds of people have come, camped in the ruins, had bonfires, had done all kinds of stuff. And so then when the archaeologists go there and find it, and they go, ha, here's a bone, ha, here's a campfire, oh, let's date it. And then it dates to, say, 1,000 years ago. And then they say, oh, well, that's when this was built. But that's not necessarily when it was built. It just tells you that's when somebody had a campfire there. And that's what happened in Namadol. So they went to one of the islands, 100 artificial islands in Namadol, and these are not on the island of Ponape. They're in the ocean. But there are these artificial islands stacked up with, again, millions and millions of tons of basalt, and then walls. Some of them are underwater, some are above water. And they went and they found a ceremonial feast that had involved a sea turtle on one of the islands, and there was turtle shell there. So they dated that, and that dated to like 1200 AD. So, you know, it's like 1,000 years ago or so. And so then they said, well, that's when this was built, because somebody had, you know, a seashell feast there. a sea turtle feast. But you see, that doesn't prove that that's when those ruins were built. Not at all. It just tells you that somebody had a sea turtle feast and that the ruins were already there at that time. But the idea
right.
that those ruins have been there for thousands of years before this feast, no, that doesn't occur to them. A similar thing happened in the Marquesas Islands right after World War II, where a Yale archaeologist named Suggs went to the Marquesas, and at that time the archaeology in the Pacific was just really beginning and in its infancy, really. He went to these megalithic, and there are also basalt platforms in the Marquesas, and unlike, say, buildings in Egypt or Peru, where the walls are perfectly fit together, in those basalt platforms in the Marquesas, there's huge gaps between the mm-hmm. basalt blocks. And so you can kind of reach down inside these platforms where there's little crooks and crevices. And the Yale archaeologist Suggs discovered in one of these platforms what was an American Civil War musket and also a French brandy bottle, both from like the about 1860 or so.
Right.
And Suggs, here he is. This guy is a Yale archaeologist, okay? I mean, we're talking PhD archaeologist writing textbooks, and he concludes that those megalithic buildings, platforms in the Marquesas, were built in the 1860s.
That's
I mean,
terrible.
The idea that those platforms had already been there for at least hundreds of years before 1860 never even occurred mm-hmm. to him. And he, even today, they try and date those megalithic platforms in the Marquesas to 1860, and which is ridiculous. And in fact,
to
show you how ridiculous it is, Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, his first book was a book called Typee. Okay, and it was his own autobiography of being a whaler in the Pacific and being shipwrecked in the Marquesas Islands. And in the book Typee, which is written around 1860, in fact, he goes to this same megalithic platform, which Suggs is dating to 1860, and he asks his native guides in the book, he says, "Wow, these things are huge, these giant basalt stones. Did you guys build this?" And his own natives on the island say, "No, we didn't build this. This was built by giants, you know, at the beginning of
yeah.
the creation of the world." You know, that's what is in Herman Melville's Typee, but the Yale archaeologist Suggs goes there in 1952 and decides that those same platforms hadn't even been built yet. I mean, that is how crazy mainstream and modern archaeology are. I mean, it is unscientific, in fact. I mean, just
yeah.
And so this is the problem with Nam Ngul, which we're not having at Gunung Padang, where yeah, they're going in there. That is not an underwater site. So and there
yeah.
are different levels and caverns, so they can go in there. They can actually find some organic material, say in theory a bone or something, and date it. Yeah, it's 20,000 years old. I mean, and that's, you know, this
do you
is
think it's
archaeology
possibly older?
As it should work, really, in a sense.
Yeah. Do you think that Gunung Padang is perhaps even older than 20,000 years?
Well,
what's your feeling about
it? It could
that?
Be. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, the
hard
whole thing of Indonesia, see, Indonesia is kind of a special place. That is what they call Sundaland. When you look at maps of the world that are, say, before 10,000 years ago in the last ice age, according mm-hmm. to geologists, ocean levels were 300 feet lower than they are today. That's
right.
10,000 years ago. If you were to lower the sea levels around Indonesia by 300 feet, you're going to have not a big island archipelago as Indonesia is. You're going to have a huge continent. And you're going to have rivers coming out of these mountains in Indonesia flowing
mm-hmm.
down into, you know, areas that are huge areas that are underwater today. In fact, even where this plane has crashed last week and that they're searching for survivors. That whole area is a very shallow. It's only 80 feet deep there.
Right.
And in fact, they're saying that will make it very easy to try and find that plane because the water is very shallow in that area. That whole area, 10,000 years ago, all that area where that plane is would have been dry land. So how about that? And that So the Indonesia of 20,000 years ago is completely different than the Indonesia we're seeing today. This is, and in my mind, that is a whole big problem for the mainstream archaeologists and anthropologists.
Yeah.
You know, they're saying like, oh, we're all out of Africa. They want to think that the way we look at the globe today and the way the continents look and the isthmuses and the island archipelagos, they want it all to look, you know, just the same, 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago. But
mm-hmm.
it didn't. I mean, the whole world has, you know, changing all the time. And there
right.
were land bridges that existed just 10,000 years ago.
Right.
The whole thing is the world's climate and just even the landforms have been quite different. If you take areas around Tahiti and Tonga, for that matter, and you drop this ocean level 300 feet, you're going to see around Tonga and Tahiti and the Tuamotu Islands, you're going to suddenly have these huge land masses in the Pacific that didn't exist today, around Hawaii as well.
Mm-hmm. You've written about the ancient Hindus and the Vedas, and you understand the Vedas and the Yugas and a lot of ancient texts. Is it your belief that human mankind, Earth humans, have been around for hundreds of thousands of years, even perhaps millions of years, as people like Michael Cremo claim in their book?
Well, right, and I know Michael Cremo and his books, and they're fascinating.
Yeah,
he believes, and many Hindus. Part of the thing with say Cremo and a lot of Hindus. When you go to ancient India and the Hindus there, they think in terms of, like geologists, of huge timelines. And, yeah, they believe that people were around hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They have a belief, too, in the Yugas, that the Yugas literally last for millions of years each. I mean, there's kind of a problem with that. You have one kind of Yuga and calculation of it where these Yuga cycles are huge amounts of time. But
yeah.
The other way to look at Yugas is more of in a Western cyclical thing of the precession of the equinoxes and all that, and the ages,
right.
where you would have more of about a 6,000-year cycle rather than say 6 million years or something like that. That all said, human beings, I think, are quite a bit older, as we are. I mean, we're at least several hundred thousand years we've been on this planet. And ancient people were not only taller than us, they had bigger brains. We weren't, you know, we weren't a bunch of, like, scrawny little hobbits running around. Ancient people, like Cro-Magnon man and stuff, I mean, they were about 7 feet tall. They had bigger bone structure. They had a larger brain than us. And they were completely capable of doing anything we can do. I mean, they had the brain, they had the sense of adventure and curiosity, the inventiveness. There's no reason why anything that we can do today and invent and create that ancient man couldn't do. The idea that ancient man would just be sitting in his cave for 200,000 years or whatever, and then suddenly 8,000 years ago or something, he just got out of his cave and started building bridges and ports and boats and roads and pyramids. I mean, that's kind of what the mainstream is telling us. Yeah, we just sat in our caves
exactly.
for hundreds of thousands
right.
of years. And then one day in Sumeria, supposedly, we just started making stuff. And then it, bang, suddenly everybody
right.
started doing things. That had to happen 50,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago, really.
Right, right. I bring it up because you've been not only filmed in Ancient Aliens, but you've written about Tiwanaku, Bolivia, and that is a fascinating place, not only because of the precision in construction of the stonework and things like that. We've had Chris Dunn on the program a couple of times, and Chris talks about his interest in it. And I think you may have been with Chris Dunn on one of your trips. But
oh yeah,
I guess,
several times. Yeah, I've been there with Chris and Egypt too. And I mean, I know him fairly well. And in fact, we made a documentary together there, Ancient Technology in Peru and Bolivia, which is available from us and from UFO TV, and you can watch it online, actually.
Right.
And the Ancient Alien Show has used footage from that.
Yeah. The reason I bring it up is that, to my mind, in the work that I've read from you, and you have kind of a background in archaeology. I mean, you went to school to kind of be an archaeologist. Of course, you know, didn't finish, but still, you have that training, you have that understanding, you have that kind of awareness of it. And then, I guess I'm a little curious because I it's like why give it up to aliens when it could have been a group of human beings that were actually around who were very, very sophisticated 20, 30,000 years ago or even longer that built this ancient city. I'm just curious about that.
Well, sure. I mean, it all depends on who you think, you know, the aliens are and whatnot. I mean, I maintain at this point that the Anunnaki are the builders of Tiwanaku, and part of the evidence for that is in my book on ancient technology in Peru and Bolivia. And in 1960, a guy, his name was Maximiliano, and he was a Aymara, was a farmer near Tiwanaku, and he had dug up near his house a large ceramic bowl, and he used it to feed his pigs for a while. But Bolivian archaeologists found it, and they actually traded him a new house, just a small house, for the bowl. And then they studied it this is 1960, and they studied it for 30, 40 years. The archaeologists studied it, and then they decided that, it was authentic, and they put it in the gold museum today in La Paz, which is really Bolivia's number one archaeological museum. And this bowl is called the Fuente Magna Bowl, or the large fountain bowl, and it was a libation bowl, and it has inscriptions on it, and there's two forms of writing in the bowl. One is Sumerian cuneiform, and the other is the earlier Sumerian hieroglyphic language, and it's even Sumerian scholars have looked at the writing and deciphered it. It's a salutation to gods and things like that. Well, look, here's the deal. That bowl cannot exist. I mean, it just can't be there as far as mainstream archaeologists are concerned. It's a bowl with two different types of Sumerian writing on it, and there's no question about that. And the bowl is in an official archaeological museum in La Paz, okay? I mean, to the mainstream archaeologists, it can't be there. That cannot exist, that bowl. It can't be in a museum. Sumerians, you know, that would prove that the Sumerians were, at the very least, capable of crossing the Pacific Ocean, and then what they did was set up a mining center in the Andes, where they mined copper and gold and silver and all kinds of stuff. I mean, that's what Tiwanaku was. It was a huge metallurgical mining center, and that bowl links it directly to the Sumerians. Now, mainstream archaeologists, I mean, it's there in that museum. National Geographic is not going to go there and do a special about it, that you won't see it on TV. It has been in the Ancient Alien Show, fortunately. But I can tell you right now that if that bowl, I believe, had been found in Peru, where Peru kind of is more in the clutches of the mainstream archaeological clutch or whatever you want to call them. But Bolivia is something of a renegade country. I mean, Bolivia just does what it wants without all these other archaeologists telling it what to do. And so they put that bowl in the museum there. But all mainstream archaeologists can do at this point is ignore it, which is what they do. They just pretend it's not there. And they don't talk about it. And yet, all you have to do is fly to La Paz, go to that museum, and it's right there on display. And there's photos of it in my book. So
that's a pretty significant,
This is a major, major archaeological discovery and item that's in a state museum, yet mainstream, I mean, they cannot acknowledge it. They can't. It would But if they ever acknowledged that that bowl was there and was authentic, it would destroy all of mainstream archaeology. And part of that is that oceans are barriers. Ancient people can't just get into a boat and go somewhere. No, they have to walk everywhere. Ancient people can't get to South America by going in a boat. They have to walk from Siberia through Alaska and then down through Panama and then get to Colombia and then walk there. They can't go in a boat
right.
because oceans are barriers. They're not highways that you can just get in and go places. And that whole thing, that's what we're taught in university. That's what, I mean, you go to the University of California, go to Yale, go to Harvard. That's what they'll tell you. And that is utterly unscientific. I mean, that is just plain wrong. Oceans are highways, not barriers. That's the easy way to go to some places in a boat, not walking everywhere through thousands of miles of hostile tribes. It's easy to go in boats. Islands like Hawaii or Easter Island, they're as remote as islands can be. The Hawaiian Islands are extremely remote, and yet they're populated by Polynesians. How did they get there? Well, of course, they got there in boats, and they went there. So, I mean, it's the easy way to go places. So that Fuente Magna Bowl.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so that Fuente Magna Bowl is utterly destroys the falsehood that people can't cross oceans, and this is what I maintain in all my books. Human beings were traveling all over the world in ancient times in boats, and they went to every continent. They would have even gone to Antarctica, although probably wasn't a whole lot to see there. But they've known, like the Peary Reese map. Today in the Topkapi Museum, which is from 1431, is dated, it shows Antarctica. It has Antarctica completely mapped. And yet, officially, Antarctica wasn't discovered until also the mid-1800s, about 1840 or so. So here you have all that. Now, put on top of that the idea of ancient flight. Yeah, yes, people could go all over the world in boats, and they do today, and they did in ancient times. What about ancient flight? That's what the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, so many of these ancient Indian texts are saying. They're saying, yeah, they had vimanas, they had flight, they were able to fly places. Look, just like today, we've got spaceships, we've got huge airplanes, we've got giant cargo lifters, we've got all that stuff, but we still use boats, and most of our cargo that's traveled around the world goes by shipping, doesn't go by aircraft, although some cargo goes that way. So even though we have all this aerospace technology, seafaring and shipping by sea is still the major activity on this planet.
Let's talk about some of these what you're just talking about, which is air flight. Now John Burke, who is an American researcher who studied a lot of the North American sites, also was at Tiwanaku, Bolivia, and did tests to discover. And what he discovered was electromagnetic fields and signatures coming out of a lot of the structures there, which makes him think, and this is documented in his book, he actually feels that the ancients had an understanding of the natural occurring telluric fields that emanated from the planet. And what he also found was he found it specifically at a number of Mayan pyramid complexes, most notably at Tikal, is that they were able to harness these fields, and then he doesn't know how they were used, but they came out of these pyramids greatly amplified. To my mind, an earlier scientific technology, maybe who knows how they used it, because we don't have any evidence of it, that could be channeled into some kind of device to fly or to travel in some way. What do you say about that?
Well, there are energy fields and magnetic fields associated with pyramid structures and also obelisks and towers. It's often been, in my mind, I would more relate this energy to an agricultural energy, more of charging the earth with energy and helping crops grow. That's one of the theories, which you might have heard of, about the round towers in Ireland. And you have, throughout Ireland, you have these ancient towers, and they're very well constructed. They're not exactly megalithic, but they're very tall and straight. They're like a tuning tower, and it's believed one of the theories there is that these towers, like a pyramid, and even just natural outcroppings of, say, basalt or granite, can not just channel earth energies and ley lines and other magnetic energies, but they can actually kind of create them themselves because of crystals. You have piezoelectric kind of properties. A similar thing like that is the strange Marfa lights outside of Marfa in West Texas. And you can see those every single night, these weird lights that go around. I've been there. I've seen it. In fact, one of the nights I was there, it was raining, and we still saw it. And you have the state of Texas has even created a little roadside rest area just for the Marfa lights, for people to look at them, and they have free binoculars and everything. So those lights, too, are some kind of earth energy that's from a pressurized fault or something like that. So I guess I would say that kind of subtle energy is, I think it's too subtle to really lift large blocks or something like that. In my mind, you need a device, and we're talking about some sort of mechanical, perhaps even handheld device. It can have to do with sound and vibration, certain kinds of rocks, and in my mind, too, it can be a very high electric charge. One way it was explained to me in Peru with the giant granite andesite blocks that are at Ollantaytambo, and there in the quarry you have what are called lazy stones. So you have these huge sort of refrigerator or car or truck-sized blocks that are squared and hewn, so that they're a big rectangular andesite block. And they tried to move them from the quarry, and the quarry has a huge road that was built coming down the hill, and then they had to get the blocks across the Urubamba River, and they never figured out how they did that. But some of the blocks never made it, and they're left along the side of the road. And they call them the lazy stones. So, and it's like these stones were floating, or they were being jumped down the road, but for some reason some of these stones just couldn't do it right, and they made part of the journey, but not all the way, and then they never made it across the river. Well, it's almost like the way it was explained to me, and I have this in the book, Ancient Technology in Peru and Bolivia, it's a little bit like you could take jumper cables, like you were putting them on a battery of a car battery, and you put a positive and negative on it, but you need a charge. You've got to have some kind of, you know, power-generating equipment or something. But you put this on, and it's a very large magnetic electric charge, and suddenly what happens is the crystals inside the granite, they'll bend. If you take a quartz crystal and you put a charge into it, the crystal actually bends and arcs, and that can create, and that makes energy. And that could make, in theory, these heavy granite blocks suddenly become weightless, and they literally jump, and they move, say, 20 feet or even 30 or 40 feet, depending on the charge and the block, and they're briefly weightless, say, just like for a minute or something like that. So that would be one way to do it. I mean, one of the things, too, that I would just say about this is that when it comes to Mayan things, the Mayans weren't – They built a lot of cities and roads, and they were, you know, good engineers and stuff, but they weren't really megalith builders. And no Mayan city is really a megalithic city, except possibly Huaxatun, which is north of Tikal. And the part of the thing with Huaxatun is that it has signs of early Olmec habitation. The Olmecs were megalith builders, and many of the things that the Olmecs did were megalithic, and they carved the giant colossal heads. They're out of basalt, and they weigh about 20 tons or something like that. So when it comes to the actual building of Mayan cities and sites, that would hardly require, say, levitation or, you know, even there, none of the stones are weigh more than, say, maybe a ton or something like that.
Right.
What the Mayans were actually very good at was concrete. And so, the Romans, and you were mentioning the Bosnian concrete and stuff, and I have been there and I've seen that. But, and concrete and liquid stone is its own special science. And being able, the Romans were very good at concrete. They poured concrete underwater like we do today. They had special forms of concrete that were especially hard. Even just a few days ago, there was an article in the news about a new analysis of Roman concrete and how they had some kind of secret ingredient in it that we don't even know what it was yet. But it made the concrete very, very hard. And the Mayans were very good at using concrete, too.
Do you believe the dates that they give to the Maya are correct? I mean, recently, Dr. Jensen, who's actually excavating a Guatemalan site, has said that he, based on his dating, that the Maya are contemporaries of the Olmec. I believe, and I've been down to Central America enough and studied the Maya and talked to the elders, I think they're many thousands of years older than what did they claim to be. Because, the archaeologists show the Maya in loincloths. And, I mean, these people were very sophisticated. My guess is they inherited their knowledge from an earlier very sophisticated people. What do you say about that?
Well, sure. Look, in my book, The Mystery of the Olmecs, I discuss the Olmecs and to an extent the Mayas in that book. And what, in my mind, what's going on is similar to what's happening in South America with Sumerians going there and others, is that there's been a trans-Pacific trade and contact between the Americas and essentially Southeast Asia for thousands of years. And the Olmecs are dated to about 3000 BC, even by mainstream archaeologists. Mm-hmm. And that's also about the date of the earliest Tiwanaku culture as well. But when you look at the Mayans and other cultures in ancient India and in China and Southeast Asia, there are tremendous similarities. One of the things, too, to point out when you go to Mayan museums and things is that the Mayans, like the Indians, use what are called mudras. And a mudra, it has to do with the positioning of your arm and your hand and your fingers. And you think of the way, say, a statue of Buddha or a statue of Shiva is sitting, Ganesh, anything like that. The way their hands are held, what they're doing with their fingers, all that has a meaning, and it's called, in Sanskrit, it's called a mudra. Just the way you put your thumb and middle finger together, all those little things, and the way with your hand is held up or down, your elbow position. And in fact, if you go to Mayan statues, they're in those same positions. They're holding their hands in certain ways, and if you know Sanskrit and Indian mudras, you can recognize this, and even what mudra they're doing. Even the way they hold their hair and knotted on the top of their head sometimes, and which was a Chinese thing. That's also how Easter Island statues are. They have this red top knot that's on the Easter Island statues. They had all fallen off the statues, but archaeologists have put them back on. And that is also a way of wearing your hair the way the sadhus in India. In India, you have these wandering holy men who have they had jobs before. They worked for the railways or something, but then this is Hindu tradition in India. You give up everything after your kids have grown up, and you leave your wife, and you go wandering around through Nepal and the Himalayas and sleeping in temples. and you grow your hair long and you tie it in a knot on top of your head. Vikings would do this, and that's what the Easter Island statues are like, and that's how the Mayans also wore their hair in many cases. This long hair was tied up on the top of the head. So anyway, what I'm saying is, for me, and the Olmecs are like this too, it's really a trans-Pacific culture. It's coming from China and India and Southeast Asia out into the Pacific, places like Tonga and the Marquesas and Tahiti and ultimately Easter Island were major ports that they would stop at on the way. But then they would reach basically, you know, Mexico and go on down to Colombia, and they brought much of the culture with them. I mean, there were already people living here. But even in Mexico, the chili and the whole salsa, the kind of chili cuisine that we associate with Mexico, that's also the same in India. They use the same kind of chilies and cuisines and everything. There's such similarities. And as a final thing, and I mentioned this in my book, Mystery of the Olmecs, at the end, you get into the writing and the hieroglyphics. It's known that the early Mayan writing and hieroglyphics and the number system all really began with the Olmecs. And they're at La Venta, which is along the Gulf Coast in Mexico, and that's thought to be the Olmec heartland. They found an offering, and it also had basalt logs there, similar to what is at Namadol or Gurung Padung. And there were these jade figurines and celts. And a celt is a kind of an axe adze, but it's made out of jade. And those celts had glyphs on them. In 1999, they brought this senior archaeologist from Beijing to Mexico City, and he was a specialist in ancient Song Dynasty early Chinese writing. This is the very dawn of Chinese hieroglyphs, and he was an expert on that. And when he looked at the writing on these statues and celts, and they're in the museum in Mexico City, he said that this writing was ancient Song Chinese writing. So he was essentially saying that, yeah, the glyphs on these early Olmec jade pieces were identical to the Song writing of ancient China, which is 3,000 to 4,000 BC.
Of course, we don't hear about that in mainstream archaeology news magazines because that would shake them up a little bit.
Well, right. I mean, here's the problem. You know, history is his story. It's not her story or their story. It's his story. And history is written by the winners of wars, not by the losers of wars. Also, today, history isn't really what happened in the past. It's what we want to have happened. It's what's politically correct. That, you know, say American Indians didn't really get along with each other and were fighting constantly, as they did in the Southwest a lot. Yeah, that's not the history. No, that's, you know, they want – history now is engineered. And, you know, it's famous that we think of the Soviets engineering history, or say North Korea today, where they create their own history of what's going on, and it doesn't have to be what really happened. It's just how they want it to be.
I want to talk about a book that you just recently wrote, The Enigma of the Cranial Deformation. I've been studying when I was in Yucatan. I went to a couple of museums that had humans that had very long heads, bound heads. These just were craniums that were just unusual looking humans. And of course, Brian Forster has been publishing the Paracas people for a couple of years now, and they have extremely long heads that cannot be attributed to binding, just because the capacity of the interior of the cranial vault holds a much bigger brain. But in that book, you talk a lot about the possibilities of another race of beings. Do you still feel that's what the Paracas were, and that possibly on Earth many thousands of years ago, there were a race of longheads?
Well, right. I mean, that's a big question. I co-wrote that book with Brian, and that's another enigma that mainstream archaeologists do not want to discuss. And that goes back to Olmecs and any culture where this these cone heads, these elongated head people, they're all over the world too. They're not just in Paracas, although we have some of the best examples from there. They're in Malta. They're in Egypt. They're in Hungary. They're in France and Germany. They're in Korea. They're in China. They're in Seattle, the Chinook Indians around Seattle. And then I went to high school in Missoula, Montana, and just north of Missoula is the largest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi, and that's called Flathead Lake. Well, Flathead Lake is called Flathead Lake because the Flathead Indians lived there, and they were called the Flathead Indians because they had cone heads. They also had these elongated, weird, elongated heads. So, and archaeologists don't ever... It's one of the things that I discovered when we did this book with Brian, was that no archaeologists and anthropologists had ever written a book about cranial deformation or these long heads. It's a subject they just don't even want to talk about. And part of the reason for that is what I was going on about earlier, is that any discussion of cranial deformation and cone heads and all that would have to discuss how these people all over the world are doing this. And even on Vanuatu, a remote Pacific island, they also, and they still do it today. There are people living there today with cone heads and stuff that where they've deformed it. And so archaeologists don't want to discuss that because then they would have to discuss the idea that this is a cultural trait that was worldwide and very unusual. And so why are people independently all over the world suddenly doing this cranial deformation or alternately just having cone heads? You know, like, what's that all about? Well, that is a subject they never, ever want to talk about because that would open the whole door to diffusionism. You would want to relate the cone heads in Peru to the cone heads in Mexico to the cone heads in Vanuatu to the cone heads in Malta and China and Egypt and all that stuff. And, no, they don't want to do that. That is, they never even want to briefly discuss that. And so, as a result, there's no discussion of this at all because it's not something that would advance this isolationist view of culture and history. Now, that all said, I mean, the big question is, was there a race of people who just naturally had these elongated skulls and that other people were then imitating them? So you've got, we know for a fact that ancient people did this deformation. They did head binding, they bound heads, we absolutely know that. And they created, and in some, I mean, it's bizarre when you look at these. And we have photos in the book, as you've seen, I mean, of living people, even, you know, from the 1920s, even right up through the 60s, who have this deformation. It's largely stopped now. Actually, the two places where it still went on, really, right, at, you know, after World War II, shall we say, were Kurdistan in northern Iraq, where all the fighting and stuff is today, and these Yazidis and stuff, they were still doing headbinding there right up through the 50s and even early 60s, and on the island of Vanuatu, which is very kind of eastern Melanesia. They were still doing this. But, you know, the big question is, was there really a race of people who didn't do the headbinding, but they just naturally looked this way and had these elongated skulls? And that is a good question. And it, I mean, more and more, I have to admit that the evidence is there that there was perhaps a race of people, and we could call them the Anunnaki, and perhaps they were part extraterrestrial, like some extraterrestrial human hybrid, but they had naturally elongated heads. And the way that we look at those, and there's one photo in the book, The Enigma of Cranial Deformation, that Brian took, and it's of a head in Paracas, but it doesn't have the normal stitching of the skull. And as your plates of your head, which are not fused when you're a baby, but eventually they do fuse as you grow up, and you can see those the fusion, the stitching of your the plates of your skull coming together. But in some of these elongated skulls, there's not that. And so that brings, you know, to a head is the idea that some of these elongated craniums are naturally that way, rather than, you know, being head binding.
So do you, maybe the binding was some form of knowledge that if the brain is positioned in such a way, it actually generates more knowledge, more subtle psychic abilities, or something like that, because the binding is worldwide. And
well,
maybe
and that's
these,
part of, yeah,
these, yeah.
Go that's ahead. Part of the thing. It's worldwide. I mean, it is. It's literally on, you know, everywhere. I mean, it's on remote Pacific islands. If you look at the daughters of Akhenaten and Nefertiti, I mean, they have these elongated heads too. Tutankhamun, he's also got this weird elongated head like that. Not all Egyptians did, but certainly the oddness and stuff look that way. It's strange. And that book, you know, one of the things we did was fill it with all the weird photos that we could get. And there's no other book that's ever been written. It's hard to even find a magazine article about
it's amazing.
About these elongated heads. Yet they're so astonishing. I found, too, that museums, particularly in Mexico, are removing any elongated heads and displays that show that. When I was at Comacalco a couple of years ago, and I've been there a number of times, and it's also a Mayan Olmec kind of port city, and then they've found bricks there with also foreign languages and Arabic and Phoenician and Egyptian hieroglyphs written on these bricks. But there used to be a big display there of statues and the Olmecs and how they looked, and it was bizarre. I mean, I have a great photo of it. I would use it in my slideshows. And some of these guys at Comacalco, they had elongated heads. Some of them looked very, very Oriental, like just exactly like some Chinese guy. I mean, that's the weird thing about the Olmecs, especially, not so much the Mayans, but the Olmecs. They are representative by virtually every race. And you have this at Tiwanaku, too, where you have bearded, mustached guys who look like they're from the Middle East, the Mediterranean. You've got Chinese-looking guys who look very, very Oriental. You have other African-looking Olmecs who look completely African, and then you have others that look more Native American. So you have all that. But anyway, this display at Comacalco, ever since Ancient Aliens started coming on and became a popular show, they've removed it. I mean, it's just simply not there anymore. Because, and I can tell you, it was a pretty strange, presentation that they had there, display. And, I mean, I thought it was pretty interesting. And then, somehow the archaeologist came and said, get that out of this museum. Don't have this here. Because it really was weird. And they don't want weird stuff in their museums. They don't want these elongated skulls. It's too strange. And then the problem is people go to the museum and they start asking uncomfortable questions, you know, like, what about this? Mm-hmm. What about that? And just like your radio show. And they don't want that. It's like the Fuente Magna Bowl in La Paz. They don't want to talk about that. They, you know, I've never seen that bowl. I don't know about that. You know, I'm sure that's not really there. So ignoring
things,
not talking about them does work, really.
Do you believe that what Michael Cremo says is true, where they do editing of historic editing, like as you're giving us an example of a museum who's removing unusual skeletal remains and maybe artifacts that are not fitting in the right historical categories? So do you believe Mexico is even removing those from their museum just because they don't want to have any questions?
No, totally. I completely believe that. And when you go to Tiwanaku today, if you go into the museum in Tiwanaku, which would be the second most important museum in Bolivia, they used to have a display of all of these skulls there. And it was part of the museum. And a good half of those skulls are elongated skulls with elongated craniums. That display has been removed. And the last time I was at Tiwanaku, just about a year and a half ago, you could not see that display anymore. They had blocked it off for no known reason. Yeah. I mean, I have photos of all that, so I can, you know, I can still show them in my presentations and stuff. But if you now go to those museums, you won't see it.
That's really too bad. It is.
And one of the questions that I've been asked many times over the years, and it's a good question, is like, well, why would there be archaeological cover-ups? Why would they do that? You know, and people are skeptical. Oh, they're not, you know, everything's transparent. They're not, oh, they made some important archaeological find. They wouldn't cover it up. We would know about it. But I'll tell you, no, as far as I'm concerned, there absolutely, as Cremo was saying, there absolutely are these archaeological cover-ups, major finds of things that are unusual, don't get into the museum. And the whole thing of the Egyptians and the Grand Canyon, those caves and the Smithsonian, supposedly excavating it. It was a huge story in the Phoenix Gazette in 1909, named the Smithsonian and various archaeologists. Smithsonian utterly denies that they did any of that. And yet, you know, at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, the famous scene where Indiana Jones says, well, where's the Ark of the Covenant now? And they tell him, oh, don't worry, top men, you know, are working on it, top men. And then the very last scene is they're putting the Ark of the Covenant into this giant warehouse and a crate, and nobody's ever going to see it. And they're basically, basically suppressing it. That happens, I'm convinced. And if a good example is like the cranial deformation, some big weird cone head. In Peru, there's so many of them that they're used to it now, that it's not some big deal. But if that was to be found in a mound in Missouri or Indiana or something, I believe the powers would be say, oh, this is too weird. Same with giant skeletons. I mean, they find a skeleton of some guy who's a normally proportioned person, but he's 9 feet tall or something. And maybe he's in, you know, copper armor with a big sword or something, and they find him in, some mound in Ohio or something. Yeah, they're going to suppress that. It's not fitting into the history that Brooks that they've written. I mean, it's a serious problem where you have these people, they're academics, they're teaching history, they're writing textbooks. But the history that they're writing is you know, some antiquated, unfactual, it's the history they want to create. And for those people who are now teaching universities, they've written the textbooks, for them to suddenly switch gears and go, well, you know, maybe I was wrong about all that stuff. Oh, maybe oceans are highways. Oh, maybe people can just cross the Pacific in boats and the Atlantic, for that matter, and the Indian Ocean, all that stuff. People can go places, and there was all this transcultural contact in ancient times. You know, it's not easy for them to suddenly switch gears and do that. By the way, an interesting thing right along those lines that has just happened in the last few days. Brigham Young University in Utah made an announcement in Egypt. For 32 years, they had been digging at this site, and they made an announcement that they had found, they'd been working there for like 30 years, that they were in this cemetery, and there was over 1 million mummies, they claimed, were in this cemetery. Many of them were red-haired, had red hair, and they talked about some of them being giants, and that they were so tall they had to be doubled over, and they're naturally mummified, actually, in this thing. So Brigham Young University made this announcement, and it got into all the news, and it was like a million mummies, and there's a whole section of these red-haired mummies and all that. Well, 2 days ago, the Egyptian government pulled their license, said it was all wrong, told the world that, they shouldn't have had their publicity announcement without the Egyptian government, and that was against the rules, that they made their own PR announcement about this thing. And now, after 30 years, Brigham Young University is not going to be excavating there anymore. Why? Because they made this announcement of 1 million mummified bodies, and there's some of them have red hair, some of them are giants, and the Egyptian government just said, oh, no, stop, what are you saying? You can't say that. We didn't give you permission to talk like that or to make an announcement. And now they're gone. They've just yanked the whole thing out of them. It's an interesting story.
It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, and we just read the other day that Zahi Hawass, who was the director of the whole Giza Plateau, is being brought up on charges of inappropriate payoffs and things like that directly connected with National Geographic, which
he's been accused of selling antiquities with Mrs. Mubarak, actually. That's one of the accusations against him. He denies it, of course.
That's part of the thing.
It's great talking to you because it's the whole history and archaeology. I mean, it's a muddled mess. And
it is. But it's interesting.
I mean,
new discoveries are
being made, but you're only going to see them on Ancient Aliens or something, it seems like.
Well, hopefully, no. We'll keep broadening it. Ancient Aliens is one avenue, but there's other potential programs. There's a program on giants right now on the Discovery Channel that's kind of interesting. But listen, we have a few minutes left. I want to talk to you a little bit about your book called Extraterrestrial Archaeology, which kind of looks at the moon and Mars. And our guest last week, I don't know if you know Mike Barra, who wrote The Dark Mission, The History of NASA with Richard Hoagland, and then he wrote two other books called Ancient Aliens on Mars 1 and 2. And he talks quite a bit about...
We're the publisher of those books, by the way.
When you mentioned that we had
published over 200 books, those are two of them.
You published those last two. But what evidence do you have, or what do you feel is evidence on Earth-based extraterrestrial archaeology? I mean, everyone talks about Lebanon, the huge, gigantic stones that are there I can't even think of the name of the place. It's Baalbek, Lebanon, as a potential place for extraterrestrial archaeology. But what's a place that you think is like hands down has all the evidence or traits of a unknown technology in place?
Well, Baalbek is a good one, simply because the stones there are the largest stones in the world that they found so far. I mean, and those blocks at Baalbek weigh over 1,000 tons. So,
yeah.
I mean, the whole idea that ancient man is going to go around carving blocks of stone that weigh 1,000 tons and then want to stack them up into walls and all that, and I mean, this is part of the whole thing. You have to ask yourself, why would they even do this? We don't do that today. I mean, we have giant cranes, we have heavy lifting machines, we've got all kinds of earth diggers and super cranes and all that, but we're not going to go out and build with 1,000-ton blocks of stone. I mean, why would we? We still build with, say, even well-constructed monuments in Washington, D.C. or something, you know, they're stones that are in those buildings, don't usually weigh more than a few hundred pounds, maybe like half a ton would be like as large a stone as they would use. And here's a stone that's 1,000 tons. And in fact, I mean, even a modern giant crane couldn't really lift that. So you have to ask yourself, like, why are ancient people who are supposedly more primitive than us wanting to do things that we can't even do ourselves, and yet they're doing it? I mean, they're actually doing it. And to me, the answer has to be that it wasn't so difficult for them as it would appear. It was somehow easy. And when you're able to levitate and just lift and move giant blocks, because literally they're weightless for a brief time, I mean, that is actually the easier way to build things than if just a few people can then build giant walls without the whole concept of having, you know, 1,000 people or more tugging on ropes with rollers and trying to move these things. You know, and when you're standing there looking at these giant stones, you think, what's the point even? But, you know, I mean, that's what makes these archaeological sites so fascinating, is you're standing right there and looking at it and going, wow, how did they do that? But when you're in Peru or Egypt or something, you know, they just say, oh, well, the Incas, just the pharaohs, whatever, whoever, they got their slaves together and they just got, you know, 1,000 people pulling on ropes and they move these things, you know. No big deal, you know. Look at it. It's right here. You know, here, scratch it with your finger. It's right there in front of you. And, you know, look, thousands of tourists every day go through Sacsayhuaman and Cusco and Machu Picchu. And, you know, they see a bunch of rocks, and they're nicely fitted together, and some of them are big and some aren't so big. And then they go and have dinner and go to bed at their hotel. And their tour guides aren't giving them any special information. In fact, they're saying, when you go to Peru, they're telling you that these giant walls were built only like 200 years before the Spanish got there. I mean, the Incas aren't some really ancient culture. They were just you know, they were right there, right? They began only right before the Spanish. So these are all these strange things. I mean, it's how you want to look at the past. And when you have basic ideas and concepts that are, you know, that you've started with, people are primitive, they don't go anywhere, they hardly know anything, but they'll do amazing things if they have to. And, you know, you're like, well, okay. And you kind of just, you don't ask all of the hard questions, you know, well, what about this? What about that? How did they do this? Why did they do it? And they have no answers, really.
Or they don't want to give the answers. Yeah.
Well, they don't have the answer. They don't know. I mean, and that's part of the thing that I think tourists and people don't realize. You go to Machu Picchu in Peru, they take you all over it. They show you where the Virgins of the Sun live. They show you where the jail was, and this is what this and this is that. But in actuality, they don't know anything about that city. They don't even know the name of it. It's not Machu Picchu. I mean, they don't know who lived there. They don't know who built it. They don't know when. They don't know the name of that city. I mean, it's just there. But when you go there, your guide doesn't tell you any of that. He makes it seem like the archaeologists have it all figured out. And they don't.
Hmm.
And, in fact, the Incas, as far as I'm concerned, the Incas didn't build that city, just like Cusco and stuff. When you go to Cusco today, it's a megalithic city. And Spanish people are living in these buildings, and their restaurants, their hotels, they're just private residences. But they didn't build those buildings. They're megalithic. They've been sitting there for at least 500 years. So the people living in those buildings didn't build them. And we could say the same thing about the Incas. They lived in those buildings. They're practically indestructible. But they didn't build them. They were already there.
Amazing. In the last minute or two, and David, you have your hands in so much. You're publishing books, you're doing your world tours and other media presentations. What do you see as this new year as something that's of interest to you personally? Like, okay, I just discovered this, I just discovered that. I mean, you mentioned the one place in the Indonesian area. But is there anything else that you think is really kind of going to be groundbreaking for the new year that you've read about? It's probably
you
so
know,
much.
I'm not really sure. I mean, geez, the year is so new. I do want to go to this Gunung Padang place. That's kind of on my list right now. And I'm fascinated by underwater archaeology. I believe that many archaeological sites are actually underwater. And probably around Indonesia, in fact. And that's part of the thing. There's probably Indonesia itself is some ancient continent, in a sense, there would probably be hundreds of sunken cities all around the Java Sea, I would think, and there would be 15, 20,000 years old. There's more than 200 known sunken cities in the Mediterranean. And, you know, they weren't built underwater. They were sunken cities. I mean, the whole world changes so much. And I believe, geologically, and you have earthquakes, you've got ice ages, whatever, Earth dying out. So we have climatic change that's been going on for really many tens of thousands of years, millions, of course, and then you have earth changes, earthquakes. California is a good example. I believe that California has been drying up for a couple of thousand years. And the whole Central Valley of California including Death Valley and Lake Mannix and all that. There was a huge inland sea there around the Fresno area and stuff like that, say 2,000 years ago. Even when the Spanish first got to California, they thought it was an island because there was so much water in the center part of California, although today it's, you know, it's completely dried up, practically.
Fascinating. Interesting. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. Where can we see you in the upcoming – are you probably going to be on another Ancient Aliens, or what's going on with you?
Well, sure. Keep watching me on Ancient Aliens and Giorgio, of course, who's a great guy. He's a good friend. And hey, people should visit our website at adventuresunlimitedpress.com and check out the books and DVDs that we sell, and we import books from all over the world. And then we have our magazine, too, World Explorer Magazine, which is all about megalithic lost cities and weird archaeological things. And that's World Explorer Magazine, and we have a website for that called WexClub.com. We're called the World Explorers Club, and we have the magazine. So WexClub.com. Not Sex Club, but Wex Club.
Where did you get the time to go anywhere where you have this business? I know, I guess your wife, Janet, is very active in your business affairs, but how can you get away?
Jennifer's her name. Well, we have an office in Illinois. Oh, we have employees. We have a warehouse. Our big distributors for the book trade is actually in Los Angeles. So we're out there. We've got employees. We got a warehouse. We got a fork truck. We ship all the time. Come and order from us. Don't go to Amazon and buy these books. You need to order them directly from us.
Well, I'll definitely publish these links to your – because I did get a copy of your – actually, your catalog is pretty intense and actually filled with a lot of great material. So,
people can go to our website and ask for a catalog, and you'll see all those books in the catalog on the website and more. So, check it out. Get with the program.
David Hatcher-Feldman, thank you for being kind of the opening for 2015. I really appreciate you being my guest, and we look forward to seeing and hearing more about you. And, of course, you're pretty much one of the voices for news and I would call anomalous discoveries in archaeology and around the world. So thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it.
All right, Cliff. It was good being on your show. Have a good year.
Thank you. You too. So that was David, and that's it for today's program. And I will publish David's web address. Also, he has a fantastic catalog of really great books. I have a number of them in my collection, and I really suggest that you take a look and find them, because Amazon is a monster, and you can get lost quickly in there. So do take a look at it. So we look forward to having you on the program next week. Thanks for joining us. Earth Ancients Radio is directly linked to Earth Ancients Facebook. You can see us on Facebook by going to Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past, and clicking on that page.